In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Across the 8th and 9th century, Britain and Ireland were targeted by a series of brutal Viking raids. But that wasn't the end of the story. In the 11th century, they were in the firing line once again, as more Viking naval expeditions were launched from Scandinavia. Dr. Caitlin Ellis, an early medieval historian at the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies, has just written an article on this second Viking age, and David Musgrove caught up with her to find out more.
Okay, so Caitlin, welcome to the History Extra podcast. Thank you for joining us. How are you today?
Good, thank you for having me.
So you've written a very interesting article for the Journal of Historical Research about Scandinavian royal naval expeditions to Britain, Ireland and its surrounding islands, which I very much enjoyed. You sent me a proof copy and I thought it was fascinating, so I thought we should have a chat about it on the podcast. So let's jump in. What's the period we're talking about here?
Yeah, so I suppose it's mostly the 11th century. I suppose technically it's a bit more 1013 to 1103, just depending on when these expeditions that I'm looking at as sort of case studies, when exactly they were. So I suppose that was one of the things I was interested in, is that we have this sort of concept of the Viking Age, but maybe there's a bit more attention to like the very beginning of that, to the early period. So I guess traditionally we would date the start of that, especially in England, from a sort of Anglo-centric point of view, we'd date it to 793 with the famous raid on Lindisfarne. And then we do sort of have a little bit of a lull in the sort of later 9th and in the 10th centuries. But then the raids kind of come back and really hit Britain and Ireland in the sort of late 10th and 11th centuries. And so some scholars have also talked about kind of like two Viking ages of Britain, because we have this kind of quieter period in raiding. But also, I suppose, because the two periods arguably are quite different, you know, in terms of the scale of raids. So, you know, we're not just talking about quite small sort of hit and run raids. You know, we're definitely talking about bigger fleets and a bigger scale, like larger numbers of ships and men involved. Also, we, in some ways, we have more information, which is helpful, obviously, as a historian. But, you know, we actually maybe know who might be leading these expeditions. So that's obviously why this article is kind of more focused on royalty, because they're probably the people who are able to command the resources to kind of launch a big expedition or even a sort of attempted invasion.
That's good. Are you sort of down with this concept of the first and second Viking ages? Where do you stand on that?
Mm-hmm. I think it's sort of helpful to show that it's not kind of the same all the way across the period. Although I suppose, again, we kind of often, from an English point of view, end up kind of dating the end of the Viking Age to 1066, which I think is a little bit simplistic, of just because we sort of go, oh, well, the Normans are here now, so that's it, that's the end of the Viking Age. But I suppose one of the things I was trying to do in that article is to show that, you know, there are still these significant kind of naval expeditions from Scandinavia after 1066. And I suppose even if in retrospect they don't necessarily have such a great impact, we don't get kind of Scandinavians ruling England again like we had Canute ruling earlier in the 11th century. So that doesn't mean that they didn't try. So I thought that they didn't have the ambition to kind of do what Canute had done earlier, or to kind of to sort of forge their own kingdoms in Britain and Ireland. So I think it's kind of, with the benefit of hindsight, we know that they didn't kind of amount to much, but I think it's still useful to remember that they maybe did have those aims in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll come back to Canute a bit, I'm sure, in this conversation. So don't worry, listeners, if you're not clear on Canute and his role in things. So you've been looking at the royal naval expedition. So we ought to consider, what's the relationship between kind of the royal families that existed in what's now Britain and what's now Scandinavia during this period? Were they sort of thoroughly aligned? Did they know each other? What was the dynamic?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I suppose also, you know, we kind of think of the English kingship at this point, I guess, has been fairly long established, with the sort of the West Saxon dynasty, you know, I guess most famously with Alfred the Great. And, you know, they kind of continued to increase their power and sort of geographical spread, I suppose, over England. In Scandinavia, it's kind of a little bit more complicated. You know, we have people who are called kings, or referred to as kings, kind of quite early on, but then sometimes we have more than one of them, you know, for the same modern country that we might be looking at. So it's kind of a more recent development in Scandinavia to have kind of one king of Denmark or Norway. I mean, the borders might not quite be the same as they are now. And I'm mostly looking at Norway and Denmark because we don't really have much evidence of the Swedes kind of getting involved in Britain and Ireland, at least at the sort of royal level. So traditionally, I suppose we think that the Swedes more go east and kind of are concentrated on the Baltic and kind of going into Russia, sort of down the rivers and so on. There probably are individual Swedes who are on some of these expeditions. So we have runestones that say that some of them joined these expeditions as sort of individuals. We don't really have so much evidence for... I suppose we assume that there must have been some kind of diplomatic contact between these kind of royal families. I suppose, yeah, more what we see perhaps it is the conflict kind of brought about by the Danish invasion and so on. And we don't really have marriage alliances actually either, whereas I suppose we could see that for Normandy. You know, we can see that the English kings, we can see that Ethelred marries Emma of Normandy, who then goes on to marry Canute, but that's... a sort of more unusual circumstance, I suppose, after him having taken over the kingdom of her dead husband.
But... yeah, quite a complicated picture there. Maybe yes. We'll pick up on that again in a minute. But we talked about that a lot in the podcast in the past, talking about the Norman Conquest and the Biotapes and things like that. What about in Ireland and Scotland? What was the nature of mm-hmm. royal rule there?
Mm. Yes, so it's quite an interesting picture for sort of Scotland particularly. So for the Northern Isles, for Orkney and Shetland, we have the Earldom of Orkney, who are sort of supposed to be, I guess, kind of notionally under Norwegian control, you know, that they're owing loyalty to the kings of Norway. So, you know, the sagas tell us that one of the kings who sort of reigns from 995 to 1000 Olaf Tryggvason of Norway, that he kind of, yeah, really kind of forces them to sort of swear allegiance to him and so on. Some scholars have argued that that's maybe slightly wishful thinking, perhaps on a Norwegian point of view, or you know, because it's from an Icelandic perspective, maybe if we had Orcadians actually writing about it, they might say something a bit different. So that's a particularly kind of interesting, that it's sort of caught perhaps between the Kingdom of Scotland and Norway. And, you know, even geographically, I suppose maybe we forget how close Shetland and Orkney are also to Norway as well. You know, it wouldn't take that long to sail from the west coast of Norway to Shetland. And so, yeah, we sort of have the emerging kind of Kingdom of the Scots. I suppose most famously in the 11th century, we have Macbeth of kind of Shakespeare renown. Ireland is also a little bit more, complicated, that it's not as kind of unified at this point as say England. We've kind of got different kingdoms. We are sort of starting at this point to get what we might call sort of a king of Ireland, but that doesn't mean that he's the only king in Ireland. It maybe just means he's the most powerful king, or that some of the other kings have kind of accepted that he's sort of top dog, you know, that he's the overlord. And then we also have sort of Hiberno-Scandinavian or Hiberno-Norse towns, so from previous waves of Viking settlement. So I guess Dublin most famously, but basically all of the towns in Ireland seem to have arisen from kind of Norse settlement or even sort of military encampments. So I suppose that's also another difference between talking about the very first raids, the very first Viking raids, and why they happen, and this period as well.
Okay, and then lastly, just to finish up the political picture, what about Wales? Wales wasn't fixed to England as it did become in later centuries, but at this point, was it?
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, that's true as well. So yes, I guess a bit like Ireland, we're sort of maybe a little bit more piecemeal in terms of these separate kingdoms. We maybe have kings who are sort of starting to dominate sort of northern Wales versus southern Wales. So Gwynedd in North Wales is particularly prominent. Also sort of maintains a lot of ties kind of across the Irish Sea. So we do see sort of connections and alliances and sort of mercenaries kind of going back and forth across the Irish Sea. So I suppose that's also useful just to think about all these kind of maritime connections, not just the sort of land-borne ones, as you say, not just that kind of Wales is attached to England. And yeah, I guess it's not until a lot later that it gets kind of gets invaded and brought into the fold.
So okay, so that's great. Thanks for that. It's quite a complicated political sort of scripture then, with lots of different elements, but certain recognisable elements to the political structure that we have today. Okay, so let's go into these royal naval expeditions that you're talking about through the 11th century. Could you sort of could you run through them, just the basic chronology of the expeditions that you've identified?
Yeah, sure. So as I said, we get this kind of resurgence or restarting of raiding, particularly on England, in the kind of late 10th and into the 11th centuries. So because I'm focusing on people who were actually kings in Denmark or Norway before they started raiding, I start with Sven Fortbeard and his son Canute. And Sven in turn is the son of Harald Bluetooth, who people might perhaps have heard of for giving his name to the technology. So I think some of the people in Scandinavia who kind of came up with Bluetooth technology, one of them had been reading a sort of historical fiction novel about the Vikings and was sort of inspired. So the idea being that Harald Bluetooth had kind of started to unite Scandinavia. You know, he was very powerful, and then Bluetooth sort of unites different communication protocols, I think it is. So I guess they're kind of got quite a sort of a firm foundation perhaps to then be able to kind of launch an expedition abroad. So I suppose Sven and Canute's expeditions are kind of the most successful in that Sven is proclaimed King of England. You know, he is able to successfully invade this kind of powerful polity. But then he dies quite quickly afterwards. So Canute sort of has to retreat a little bit and then kind of reinvade. So it's a little bit more of a drawn out conquest, I suppose, if we were comparing it to the later Norman conquest. So that's the first one. And then we have a little bit of a lull again, I suppose, perhaps because Canute is reigning for a few decades and he's quite powerful. So that might be one factor that's kind of keeping everyone else at bay. And then there's sort of a particularly sort of interesting case, but not one that we have a lot of kind of detailed evidence for in the sources. In 1058, all of their kind of insular sources, so all of the sources from Britain and Ireland, kind of talk about there being the son of the King of Norway, who's just sort of there. We don't quite know why. So the son of the more famous Harald Hardrada, and he's called Magnus. And he just sort of seems to get involved in kind of more local situations that are maybe already happening. I argue that kind of he maybe was initially just travelling to Orkney, but then kind of joined some fleets. So we have people who are kind of rebelling against Edward the Confessor in England. So this maybe seems a little bit more opportunistic that he just kind of sticks around and takes part in some existing events. And then I guess more famously, we obviously have his father then a few years later in 1066 attempting to invade England, but sort of ultimately unsuccessfully, although, you know, and arguably, I suppose, then paving the way for the successful Norman conquest, you know, that the English have managed to fight off Harald Hardrada, Harald's sort of hard ruler or harsh counsel, sort of different ways that we can translate that epithet. So the English are obviously able to fend him off at Stamford Bridge, but then obviously have to march all the way south to Hastings to meet William the Conqueror. And then that's potentially one of the factors that means, you know, they're tired, basically, so that they're less successful in the battle there. We also have kind of continued Danish attempts maybe after the Norman conquest. To us, maybe we know that William the Conqueror kind of had a fairly long reign and he kind of establishes a whole new kind of dynasty over England. But I suppose perhaps at the time they didn't necessarily realise it was going to be so long lasting. You know, similarly, you know, we'd had the Danish invasion that had lasted for a little while, but then had led to sort of the previous dynasty being restored. So maybe from their point of view, something like that could have happened again. It might not have been such a kind of foregone conclusion. Obviously, now we know that William the Conqueror was kind of quite effective at really kind of cementing his power and so on. So it does seem like the Danes are still sort of trying to chance their arm a little bit or kind of support English rebels against the Norman conquest. But then sometimes by the time the Danes arrive, William the Conqueror has already kind of like quashed the rebellion. So they sort of attempt to kind of unite and make a stronger consolidated force. But by the time their ships get there, they usually just end up kind of burning some stuff and going home. And then the last one is Magnus Barelegs, who's excellently named. We don't quite know why his legs are bare. There's a few different stories in the sagas that maybe once he gets attacked and he sort of hasn't had time to put his trousers on, or maybe he's wearing something, maybe he starts wearing a sort of more Irish or sort of Scottish type of dress. So, which I guess nowadays for us is you start to picture him in a kilt or something, but that's probably a bit anachronistic. So his expeditions are mostly concentrated on the Northern Isles and kind of Scotland and the Irish Sea region. And into Ireland. So he doesn't actually seem to try anything against England specifically, but yeah, more focused on the Earldom of Orkney, which he does sort of end up bringing under direct control rather than just having a kind of looser overlordship. He sort of temporarily is able to put his son in charge. So that's quite significant maybe in the history of the Earldom.
Great. Okay, well, that's given us the picture. I'm wondering, How do we know about these events? What are the sources that that you can pull on for them?
In terms of sort of sources from Britain and Ireland, we're sort of a bit better served that we have all these kind of chronicles and annals. So obviously the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, I suppose, is perhaps the most well known And then we also have different manuscripts or different kind of recensions of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, you know, where it's being kind of compiled at different, you know, monastic institutions or kind of in different parts of England. So sometimes you can kind of see some kind of regional biases that, you know, one version of the Chronicle might write about one event at kind of great length and clearly thinks it's very significant, whereas maybe another version will just give you a very kind of straightforward, short, like, yeah, whatever. Or you can maybe see that, you know, if there's a dispute, say, between the King of England, between Edward the Confessor and the Godwinsons, one version of the Chronicle is sort of more pro-Godwinson and sort of, you know, they've been cruelly done wrong and had to go into exile, whereas the other version is more supportive of the king, for example. So it says we still have to be aware of, there might be some slight agendas and things going on. It says we maybe tend to think that chronicles and annals are quite kind of reliable because they're quite straightforward and they're not so obviously sort of narrative, I suppose. We have annals from Ireland as well and from Wales in both kind of Latin and Welsh. Scotland is quite poorly served, so sometimes things that are happening in Scotland might be kind of mentioned by these other annals. And then from a Norse point of view, we have the sagas, but then they're a lot later, so they're the 13th century, whereas, you know, if I'm talking about the 11th century, there's obviously that kind of degree of remove that we maybe need to take them a bit more with a pinch of salt. I suppose, yeah, there's quite a big debate in sort of Scandinavian history as to how much we should use the sagas, how much we should trust them. I think I end up using them because we don't have much else, so it seems like we might as well. Sometimes we've got continental sources, of course, that we'll talk about Scandinavia, sources from Germany and so on. We have a bit of archaeological evidence as well. Things like coinage can obviously tell you things about kings and sort of how they're presenting themselves or where they're saying they're king of. So, you know, we have lots and lots of English coinage, which is found in Scandinavia in this period. Some of it might be the result of trade, but I suppose we're usually assuming that it's stuff that they've taken when they're raiding, or payments that have been made to try and get them to go away. So sort of this kind of protection money in a way that's sort of referred to as gaffel in Old English, as tribute. I suppose later we kind of refer to it as the Danegeld, the sort of the payment. So yeah, we have all this English coinage which makes its way to Scandinavia. And then we then get the Scandinavian kings themselves kind of copying that coinage, but then putting their name and their title and their face on it instead. So that's quite interesting as well about that even though they're sort of maybe attacking England, that maybe they're also taking some inspiration from it as well, at least sort of ideologically or politically.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I think in some ways it is strong and weak at the same time, because that's sort of because it's more unified, you know, you kind of just have one king to get rid of, whereas actually if you're in somewhere like Ireland or Wales, it probably is a more complicated conquest.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
And what about ships themselves as sources? I mean, obviously, there's various reconstructions at fabulous places like Roskilde and things like that. Do they help inform the picture?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So actually, yeah, Roskilde, the ship museum there, they have the warship, which I think is called Skaldalive 2, because there's another Skaldalive. And that one is... has sort of been dendrochronologically dated, you know, testing the wood to around 1042, and that they think the wood was actually grown kind of in the area around Dublin. So obviously for me, this is sort of such a wonderful example of these kind of maritime links kind of across the North Atlantic, across kind of Scandinavia and Britain and Ireland. And then it seems like it was repaired a couple of decades later, maybe still in kind of Britain and Ireland. But then at some point it ends up being sunk in Roskilde Fjord, sunk in Denmark. It sort of seems like it's maybe being used as a sort of underwater kind of like naval barrier, that you sort of make it a bit more difficult for ships to come in and attack you, or they kind of need to know what course to set to get there. So there's a few other ships there as well, and some of them are a bit more what you might think of sort of merchant ships, whereas this one is definitely more of a long ship. You know, it's more it's not got as much room for cargo and so on. It's sort of narrower and longer, so it's a bit more kind of maneuverable. So I mean, obviously the Viking ship, I suppose, is such a sort of famous, sort of classic, evocative image. You know, obviously we have it on lots of book covers and so on. You know, we do have the ships that were found sort of in Norway that are in Oslo, that are kept in Oslo now. They're a bit earlier. They're from the 9th century. So we do have the ships kind of all the way through, but I suppose arguably by this point they're a little bit more sophisticated and might kind of allow them to do a bit more and kind of undertake these slightly longer journeys. But yeah, it's definitely something, obviously, that the Vikings are known for, this kind of naval prowess.
So sort of highlighted a few different expeditions there in your summary. Can you give us a sense about how big you think these expeditions were? What sort of fleet sizes are we talking about coming from Scandinavia to Britain?
Yeah, so we get a few kind of different figures in the sources. So some of them supposedly have kind of maybe 200, 300 ships. So they say obviously a much larger scale than maybe some of these early raids on Lindisfarne, where we might just be thinking of a couple of ships. So sometimes we have different sources giving us a slightly different number of ships for the same event. So it's difficult to know whether that's just one of them's wrong and has got confused. There have been some arguments that say when it's the number of ships for when Harald Hardrada tries to invade England, that maybe actually he's gained some ships on the way. So that might be why there's a difference of opinion, why the numbers are different, that he might have set off with a certain number, but then maybe he gains, you know, 20 more or something in Orkney to sort of bolster his troops on the way. So probably fairly significant. Some people, I think, have tried to kind of calculate like how many people would be in each ship, and so on. I think it's maybe a little bit difficult to do. But
so look, you've identified kind of push and pull factors for these journeys to try and explain what was going on. Should we talk about them for a second? What are the push factors that were driving these expeditions?
Yeah. So I, as you say, tried to divide it into sort of push and pull factors. I was also thinking about the push factors, obviously being a bit more the kind of the Scandinavian situation for sort of what are the conditions that they might need at home to be able to launch these expeditions, and particularly invasions, as we've said, if this is quite a big undertaking, that, you know, you would need support. So that, I guess, that was one of the factors. How powerful is the king in the first place? Maybe how much support does he have? So, you know, we know that in 1085, confusingly also called Canute, but a different Canute to the famous Canute that rules England, a few generations later, and he becomes a saint, as almost you see him referred to as Canute the Holy. So he we know that he's like planning to launch a really big invasion, that he's kind of gathering ships, but then there's a rebellion against him, so it never ends up happening. So I guess that's quite a sort of explicit kind of dramatic example of this idea that you would need kind of the backing, particularly probably of the sort of the aristocracy, the nobility, you know, the next level under the royal dynasty. Perhaps also you need to be secure kind of within your own family. So this Canute that planned the invasion, his brother seems to be very instrumental in this rebellion and in getting him killed. So obviously that's a bit of a potential problem when we're thinking about succession and so on. And this was another problem for the Scandinavians, is often that they might be having a sort of an internal conflict, so between Denmark and Norway, say. So presumably if you're not kind of feeling secure enough in your own position, you're probably not going to risk kind of being away and taking a lot of your kind of your fleet and your army with you. So I think, we sort of have that initial period. This was one of my first case studies, are kind of Danish rulers. Then it seems to a bit more be from Norway. But then after 1066, as I said, it sort of switches back to the Danes again, which I think is partly probably because Harald Hardrada died. So because he seems to have been kind of quite a powerful ruler and, you know, a very successful military general until Stamford Bridge, I think, you're probably not going to want to go and try and invade England if you're kind of worried that Norway might invade you while you're away. And then sometimes there seems to be tensions with Germany as well. So I suppose, again, you're not, if you're kind of aware of that border, particularly for the Danes, obviously, geographically, Germany is more of a threat to them. So I think that was most of the push factors, which is obviously this idea of inheritance maybe as well, that, you know, maybe the Danes are trying to sort of get their inheritance from Canute, you know, just there's been this hiccup in the middle from their point of view. And then the pull factors I looked at, so yeah, thinking then more about the sort of the British and Irish context of kind of what draws them essentially to these places. So I suppose wealth is obviously a kind of an obvious one. As I said, we have lots of kind of English silver, lots of English coinage that has made its way to Scandinavia. So that's probably quite appealing to them. And then potentially, I guess, the if they are actually able to take a new kingdom or sort of take power there too. Sometimes people have argued that the fact that there are these sort of Scandinavian settlements from sort of the earlier period of activity, I guess, might also be a draw in a sense, or at least it might make it easier when they are there, that maybe those people would support the kind of the new Scandinavians coming in. I think sometimes that's a little bit simplistic. I'm just assuming that they'll definitely sort of have this kind of sense of common feeling, but you know, the people who, even in what became known as the Danelaw, even if they were originally sort of from Scandinavia or Denmark, you know, they've now been living in England for kind of several hundred years, so they wouldn't necessarily think of themselves as the same as people who've just come from Denmark. So we do get some people from that area kind of supporting Sven and Canute, but I think it's probably more just sort of politically kind of opportunistic, and because there's other disputes going on. So also, I guess, another pull factor would be kind of weakness, for example, in England. So we do have sort of disagreements, I guess, among scholars now about whether England in the 11th century is actually really strong. And, you know, that's why everyone wants it. That's why everyone wants to try and take it, because it's really wealthy and it's this great prize. And, you know, it's sort of administratively maybe quite sophisticated. But then other people say, oh, you know, but it got conquered twice in the 11th century. So, you know, it can't have been doing that well. And, you know, it must have been really weak. And, you know, we do have sources obviously talking about kind of rebellions against the king and sort of lots of squabbles and so on. And sometimes that might be about the succession issue as well. So obviously Edward the Confessor dying childless in 1066 obviously kind of creates the situation that a few people try and exploit, you know, Harold and William as well. I think in some ways it is strong and weak at the same time, because that's sort of, because it's more unified, you know, you kind of just have one king to get rid of, whereas actually if you're in somewhere like Ireland or Wales, it probably is a more complicated conquest, and we do see that later on when the Normans tried to take over both of those places, that you know, you can take over one kingdom in Ireland, but then you've still got lots left, or in Wales. Whereas I suppose, you know, if Canute takes, you know, when he becomes king of England, he kind of does already have all of the apparatus is already in place that he can just kind of slot in on the top. And he does make some changes, and but I suppose he doesn't have to start from scratch. There's already a sort of system in place that he can use to rule, which is probably quite useful.
You just made a really interesting point in your answer there about sort of nationalistic affiliations or ethnic affiliations, perhaps. Like, well, you know, we think of it today, we think, well, if someone's from Denmark, they're naturally going to support the Danes. If someone's from Norway, then ditto, and someone's from England, the same. That doesn't apply then in the 11th century. You don't think people didn't have that same sense of affiliation to an identity, or how did it play out?
I mean, you know, I think they probably did have senses of identity, and even if it's not so much national identity, or, you know, maybe even their sort of like linguistic identity might have been more helpful. So there's also kind of religious identity, although obviously by this point, and again, I realize in the sort of the popular perception of Vikings is probably a sort of pagan, you know, godless heathens who are attacking churches and so on. But certainly by this point, you know, they're basically Christians themselves, and have been for a little while, some of them. I think often just sort of practicality is almost most important. Either for its kind of personal ambition or we do see these alliances that kind of, yeah, go across kind of national or sort of ethnic divides. So it seems like Ethelred the Unready, before the Danish invasion, that he makes alliances with some Scandinavian Vikings, which, you know, presumably is just sort of motivated militarily, that he thinks this is actually quite a good policy, or, you know, that you can try and get some of them on your side, and you can sort of play one group of Vikings kind of off against another. So we're definitely not kind of just seeing it as really clear cut kind of English versus Scandinavian or versus Danish. And Ethelred is also seems to be dealing with kind of disputes between different factions of nobles, kind of different parties sort of at court, and are also making things a bit problematic. And it may even well be that his eldest sons are also kind of had a dispute with him as well. So there's definitely kind of a lot of kind of complicated court politics going on that doesn't just seem to be about their origin.
Ethelred had a tricky hand to play, certainly, didn't he? Oh, and we should just be clear. So Ethelred is the King of England before mm-hmm. Sven and Canute turn up in the early part of the 11th century, and as you said, mm-hmm. has the unfortunate moniker of Unready.
Yes.
So
certainly he has quite a bad reputation, I guess, but particularly nowadays, although obviously we've maybe had some more like revisionist ideas that as you say, he had a bad hand to play. It's not just it's not just his own personal failings necessarily that lead to the Danish invasion. You know, he's having to deal with, yeah, large fleets and a sort of quite a rate of attrition in a way of these kind of regular raids against the country. So he did have quite a tall order, and obviously he'd had quite a long reign and been fairly successful before then. But then, yeah, obviously in the end he loses it, which I suppose is what everyone remembers.
Can we let's move it forward 50 years or so? You've mentioned Harald Hardrada mm-hmm. a couple of times, and he's a fascinating figure, Hardrada. And in the sort of the narrative of English history, if you know about the Norman conquest, you know, as you've mentioned, that he turns up, wins one battle, loses another, and then dies, and that's the end of the story. And kind of you hear no more about him. He kind of appears suddenly on the stage and then disappears. Who was Hardrada, and why was he such an important figure?
Yeah, certainly. So he's had quite a sort of unusual route to kingship in a way, in that he spent a lot of time in Byzantium, in sort of Constantinople, in the kind of the potentially in the kind of the bodyguard of the emperor there, and sort of serving as a general. And sort of having conflicts with kind of all sorts of peoples, with the Bulgars and people sort of to the east of Byzantium. So in this period, we talk about a sort of body called the Varangian Guard, as this sort of kind of elite personal bodyguard of the emperor. And it seems like they preferred kind of northern warriors, so particularly kind of Scandinavians. We do get some English people in it as well. So yeah, I guess he's kind of gone and had this sort of successful sort of military career kind of outside Scandinavia. And then he kind of returns, presumably with kind of some supporters and some wealth that he's kind of gained while he was away, that he can then kind of leverage when he gets back. So he's the half-brother of a previous ruler, and I think he's actually the technical terms is a uterine half-brother, isn't it? That they shared the same mother rather than the same father, who is Saint Olaf, who I guess sort of becomes seen as the kind of patron saint of Norway. Although it doesn't actually seem like he was very popular in Norway at the time. You know, like they kick him out once and he tries to come back again. And then the Norwegians probably still don't really want him back. So then he gets killed in battle, trying to restore the throne. But then the fact kind of that he is martyred in a sense, and that he becomes a saint, actually then seems to be quite useful in a way to his sort of relatives and his descendants, that they can kind of attach themselves to this royal saint who's sort of seen as the kind of protector of all Norway. So Olaf's son is ruling for a little while, and then Harald kind of returns, and then it seems like they kind of agree to share power for a bit. Not really sure how much choice the son had in that, or if that was just sort of the necessary decision to make. But then he dies, so Harald kind of becomes the sole king, and yeah, he's, as I say, he'd been sort of fairly successful within Scandinavia as well, so he's often sort of having conflicts with Denmark and even with Sweden as well. But I think that this, according to the sagas, they sort of reach a truce, him and the Danish ruler, in the sort of early 1060s. So that again might kind of make it a bit easier for him then to decide that he is going to try and get England. I guess his claim on England is a bit tenuous if we're thinking about kind of traditional ideas of inheritance or sort of primogeniture. So according to the sagas, the one that he'd been sharing rule with, the son of Olaf, who's also called Magnus. So a lot of the Scandinavian kings in this period have the same name, which can make things a little bit tricky. According to that, he had an agreement with one of the sons of Canute, who were both childless, and they said, well, you know, whichever one of us dies first, the other one can succeed to their thrones. So that's sort of supposedly where he kind of gets his claim on England from. But I suppose in a lot of the medieval period, your claim to the throne, I suppose, might more just be based on your military ability and on your popularity, rather than necessarily on actually who was officially the successor.
And as you say, Hardrada had quite a lot of military ability and prowess. And it, as I said, mm-hmm. so he loses at Stamford Bridge, and from an English perspective, yeah. that's, you know, he loses to King Harold the Second of England. Mm-hmm. And from an English perspective, that's the end of his story. But it stands to reason that actually the demise of a significant military figure in Scandinavia would have an impact on what happens in Scandinavian politics, and I guess on your story of the cross mm-hmm. cross-Atlantic travel picture. So it's quite significant, I suppose, the end of Hardrada.
Yeah. So and it also seems like he brought one of his sons kind of with him when he's trying to do this invasion, who's kind of allowed to leave, and you know a few kind of surviving kind of remnants of his army, I guess, are able to flee from Stamford Bridge and probably go back to Orkney, where he seems like he's also left some of the rest of his family as this sort of slight place of safety relative to England. So yeah, his son, also called Olaf, unhelpfully, who becomes known as Olaf Akiri. So Olaf, the kind of the quiet or the sort of peaceful. So he is quite a sort of successful reign of Norway in terms of kind of sort of political consolidation, and these are sorts of like church patronage, and maybe like found some important towns even today. But he seems to not go for sort of big military expeditions. Whether we want to attribute to that to some kind of personal sense of, you know, he's seen his father be killed in battle, or just that from a practical point of view, maybe their military has been kind of significantly weakened. You know, you've lost a lot of your warriors, as you say, because there was the battle at Fulford as well before Stamford Bridge, even though that was initially successful for the Norwegians. So it maybe gives Denmark a bit more freedom of action at this point, as I say, when the Danes when they launch some expeditions against England in the sort of late 1060s and the 1070s. So I say it's not until Harald's grandson, the Magnus Barelegs, that I guess Norway sort of tries this big expedition to the west. Although even then, I guess he's not really trying for England, as far as we can see. And certainly the sources do, the sort of the Scandinavian sources, which can maybe be a little bit more colourful, a little bit more poetic in a sense. You know, they make comparisons between him and his grandfather, or maybe suggest that he's sort of somehow trying to like seek vengeance for his grandfather. But as I say, because he's not actually really, really aiming for England, I don't think that really, really was the case. But perhaps he was sort of inspired by the kind of the vague sort of example of that, of sort of winning fame and renown, at least, even if not the kingdom.
Okay, fascinating stuff. Let's wrap up just with a final question. What's the bigger picture here? What does this? So you're describing a century basically of quite a lot of interest from Scandinavian rulers in what's happening in Britain and Ireland and the surrounding islands. What does this all tell us about what's happening in the 11th century in terms of international relations around the North Atlantic?
I suppose one of the sort of bigger picture things I wanted to get across was that again, we kind of have this image of the Vikings, I guess, as being sort of inherently kind of ruthless and sort of indiscriminately kind of violent, maybe a bit more influenced by these sort of very early raids, when the sort of writers at the time who were sort of in monasteries being attacked and so on, kind of, you know, we obviously have these very vivid accounts of their kind of horror and shock at kind of what is happening. But as I say, you know, this is now a couple of hundred years later. The kings of Scandinavia probably are a lot more powerful, maybe do feel like they can kind of rival kings in Britain and on the continent more. I suppose Canute, I suppose, being the most obvious example, you know, as someone who's able to rule England, Denmark and sort of Norway in one period. But, you know, he's also kind of going on pilgrimage to Rome, and he's sort of making alliances with the German emperor. So he does seem to be, I guess, operating on quite an international level. So I'd say we're still quite far from this idea of, yeah, kind of sort of almost bloodthirsty barbarians in a way. I was saying they're probably just as Christian as the English at this point. And I suppose I would also think with these sort of push and pull factors that that maybe that they were still sort of making reasonably informed decisions, or at least trying to, there's still sort of practical things that might prevent them from launching an expedition, or kind of contribute to how it's successful or not. And I suppose, yeah, maybe in a sense you can also see some of the same issues in Scandinavia, if we really reduce them to the basics, in Scandinavia and in Britain and Ireland as well, that if, if I've been sort of talking about Scandinavian kings kind of needing the support of their subjects, and the sort of the nobility, and then even people in their own family, being worried about kind of rebellion and so on. You know, I guess we do also have that for the English kings as well. If we are seeing that as kind of potential weaknesses, that the Scandinavians might be able to exploit, such as the famous example is Eadred Streiner, who's one of the kind of English nobles who just kind of switches sides, but then he's also like takes a fleet that, you know, they've been working really hard on the English to try and sort of counter this Scandinavian naval prowess. They've been building ships and he just takes them all with him and kind of switches sides. Well, that doesn't work out very well for him in the long run, I guess, because Canute still has his head chopped off, presumably doesn't trust him very much.
That was Caitlin Ellis. You can find plenty more on the Viking period on our website, historyextra.com. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.